Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today we present Professor's talk number 10 in the current series. Over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is talk number 10 in my current Dharma series, and today I move on to chapter 4, which is titled Arjuna's Despair. In a way, I welcome this transition because it brings me closer to the central point about Dharma, which is what Krishna taught to Arjuna in the latter's moment of despair. Some background is needed, and since Das does not provide it, let me fill in. If you recall, when Yudhishthira allowed himself to be drawn into playing the dice game for a second time, certain conditions were stipulated in case the Pandavas lost. Of course, with that pathological cheater Shakuni playing for Duryodhana, Yudhishthira duly lost the second time also, and had to withdraw to the forest, accompanied by Draupadi and his brothers. The Pandavas spent 12 years in the forest, and followed this by spending one more year incognito. When, after all this, the Pandavas reappeared in public, Duryodhana claimed that they had revealed themselves before the stipulated closure time, and therefore had to repeat the exile once more. The Pandavas, however, stood their ground and made several efforts to argue their case with Duryodhana. But Duryodhana was stubborn. In fact, Krishna himself became involved in the mediation process and went to the Kaurava court to personally plead on behalf of the Pandavas. Making a most generous offer, Krishna told Duryodhana, "Duryodhana, I notice that you are firm about keeping the entire Pandava kingdom, dismissing their contention that they appeared in public only after the completion of the incognito period. Okay, let it be so. But would you be generous enough to give at least 5 villages to the 5 brothers? Duryodhana's contemptuous reply was, "No 5 villages. In fact, not even 5 pinheads of land. The Pandavas failed to fulfill the agreement, and their kingdom is now ours, according to the terms agreed to earlier." The Pandavas, of course, were not surprised by Duryodhana's reply, but were incensed, and rightly so. It was then decided that war would be waged against the Kauravas to settle the issue, and a place, date and time for the war to begin were agreed to by both parties. Thereafter, both sides began reaching out to relatives, friends and well-wishers for armed support. Krishna declared he would personally not fight for either side, but was prepared to offer his army if asked for, and his services as an advisor if sought. Duryodhana promptly asked Krishna to spare his army, while Arjuna sought Krishna as an advisor. I am sure that all this is well known to our audience. Let me therefore come straight to the point where Arjuna, who earlier was itching for the fighting to begin, was now beginning to have deep reservations about the war and the destruction it was bound to cause. More importantly, Arjuna feared that Dharma itself would receive a deep setback if the war were to be fought. This is how Arjuna conveys his fear and anxiety to Krishna, his charioteer. Arjuna says, "O Madhava, it does not behove us to kill our kinsmen, for how can we be happy after killing our blood relatives? Enslaved by greed, they might not see evil in being treacherous to their own kith and kin. That being said, I cannot but recoil from destroying their families, for when men die, families are ruined. Indeed, that is what war would do to both sides. The family is the cornerstone of society, and when families are destroyed, age-old traditions would perish, and virtue would go into hiding, whereupon vice would get a firm grip on society. Women would become unchaste as a result, and family lineages would be lost forever. As is well known, promiscuity ruins both the family as well as the defiler. And when families are destroyed, O Krishna, the traditional offerings to departed ancestors would cease completely, and their souls would languish. Turning to his other reservations, Arjuna continues and says, O Madhusudana, how can I engage Bhishma and Drona in battle? They, who are worthy of my deepest reverence, far better it is to beg and live on alms than to slay these respected elders. The victory and all the enjoyments resulting from their killing would be bloodstained. Nor do I know which is better, whether we conquer them or they conquer us. Since after killing those sons of Dhritarashtra now arrayed before us, I should not care to live. My being is paralyzed by feebleness and my mind perplexed about duty. Hence, I ask and pray to thee, tell me please, in no uncertain language, what is good for me. I seek refuge in thee. That's what Arjuna said to Krishna. As Swami has pointed out, it was when Arjuna declared that he sought refuge that Krishna, who was in fact Arjuna's brother-in-law, decided to play the role of one who gives refuge. He had incarnated for playing that role. Swami has stated on many occasions that Lord Narayana incarnated in the Dwapara Yuga as Lord Sri Krishna mainly to deliver a message to humankind. It is noteworthy that back then this message was delivered just once, and that too to just one person. The events that preceded the scene just described were carefully choreographed by the avatar of the age to create the right occasion for the delivery of God's message to humankind. And Arjuna was merely an instrument through whom the message was delivered. Before proceeding further, I should at this point draw attention to the following. Firstly, Arjuna says he does not know what exactly his duty is. In other words, he raises the issue of duty, which is important for us. Next, when he talks about war leading to a decline of virtue and the ascendancy of vice, breakdown of the family, family tradition, etc., etc., Arjuna is actually referring to dharma. All things considered, Arjuna seems to feel that avoiding war would be good for dharma, and thus his duty at that juncture was to refrain from fighting in order to preserve dharma. In the process, also avoiding the horrible crime of killing his revered grandfather and disrespected guru. On the other hand, the decision to wage war had been taken after much thought. Could he, after vociferously demanding war, now back out? Arjuna was caught in the horns of a dilemma, and this precisely is what Dharma Sankatam is all about. I shall have more to say about Dharma Sankatam later, but for now we note that Krishna's answer to Arjuna's doubts was offered as a song celestial, or the Bhagavad Gita as it is better known. The Gita elevates the issue raised by Arjuna to the spiritual plane and unambiguously declares that while the causes for a particular action might be the result of worldly circumstances, the motivation for that action must be rooted in spirituality, always. In other words, questions about right and wrong, morality, duty, dharma, etc., etc., must all be discussed starting from the spiritual plane. You may recall that in an earlier talk, I drew attention to Aurobindo's caveat about not missing the connection between dharma and spirituality. Well, as you can see, we have a very heavy agenda ahead of us, and before I get into all that, allow me to mention the following. Playwrights often add spice by posing dilemmas to their characters. The dilemma of Hamlet is very well known, but not so well known is that faced by Lady Blanc in Shakespeare's King John, caught in a quandary about whom she should support in a conflict that was brewing. Lady Blanc wails, and I quote, "Which is the side I must go with all? I am with both, each army has a hand, and in their rage I am having hold of both. They whirl asunder and dismember me. Husband, I cannot that thou mayest win. Uncle, I need must pray that thou must lose. Father, I may not wish fortune thine. Whosoever wins on that side I shall lose. Assured loss before match is even played." Alas, Lady Blanc did not have Krishna to advise her. It is now time to connect with Gurcharan Das briefly. He appears to regard the Gita as an extended effort made by Krishna, wherein he, that is to say Krishna, uses a variety of arguments to persuade Arjuna to fight. Here are some clips of how Das views the Gita. He begins with the remark, and I quote, "Krishna devotes the next 700 fratricidal verses to persuade Arjuna to fight, and this becomes the Gita." End of quote. As for the phrase fratricidal verses, Das says in his note, 700 fratricidal verses are the words of Marxist historian D.D. Kosambi, as given in his book, An Introduction to the Study of Indian History, 2nd edition, Bombay, Popular Prakashan, 1975. End of quote. I make a particular reference to Professor Kosambi because I have seen him way back in the mid-50s when I used to work in the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, or TIFR as it is better known. Kosambi worked there as a professor of statistics. Most of the time he was a one-man department. Later I saw him take a student, but that was about it. Kosambi was obviously very good in everything he touched and enjoyed high international repute. However, he sure was peculiar in many ways. For example, he would commute every day between Pune and Bombay, a distance of about 190 kilometers, using the famous Deccan Queen that ran between these two cities, now renamed Pune and Mumbai, respectively. Kosambi used a backpack way back, and I'm sure he must have improvised it himself, for backpacks did not exist commercially in those distant days. Few knew that Kosambi had another side to him as a historian. I dimly recall seeing an article of his on ancient coins in the Scientific American. Checking the net for more, I have come to realize that the man I used to see in the evenings going to the station to catch the Deccan Queen was a multifaceted genius who highlighted for the first time the unique contribution Indian villages have made to social development. Well, it's time to end that brief digression and get back to Das, whom I must now quote in extenso. Das says that Krishna's first argument was that Arjuna must fight because it is his duty as a warrior. Das continues that the duty argument of Krishna seems to have had little effect on Arjuna. So, Krishna sweetens it with an offer of heaven, meaning that if Arjuna were to die fighting, he would ascend to heaven. Das then says that, and now I quote, "Since this duty argument does not move Arjuna, Krishna tries a metaphysical approach, arguing that only the body dies and not the soul. In killing his enemies, Arjuna would be destroying only the transient body, not the Atman, the real self, which would continue to exist. Arjuna, however, is a man of action and appears to be impervious to metaphysics. So, the divine charioteer, Krishna, next resorts to a truly novel moral argument based on action. When an individual acts for the sake of his work rather than for personal reward from it, Krishna says, the individual is likely to do the right thing. This moral insight is famously called Nishkama Karma or Nishfala Karma. Nish means without in Sanskrit. Kama means desire. Phala means fruit. Karma is action. So, all things taken together, Nishkama karma means disinterested action or an action performed without thinking of its fruit. Krishna does not define what right action is. Any action performed in a selfless spirit is superior, says Krishna. That is the end of quote. Das continues, and once again I quote, Arjuna's moral dilemma is about which duty he should follow. Should he observe Krishna's advice, that is to say, follow his kshatriya ethic and fight a just war in order to uphold a higher good and preserve just order, or should he follow the call of his conscience, which is to be a non-violent human being and not to kill his own family members, elders, teachers, etc.? Arjuna must choose whether to be a dutiful kshatriya warrior, fight this dharma yuddha, or he can be a non-violent human being and save the life of his family and kin. It's a dharma sankat, a tragic dilemma. Both choices involve serious wrongdoing. There seems to be no right answer. Krishna points to Arjuna's duty to fight irrespective of the consequences. It's a just cause, and as a warrior and commander of the Pandava forces, he must obey his kshatriya duty and take up arms. Krishna's advice assumes that the moral worth lies in a person's motives rather than in the consequences of the action. Arjuna, on the other hand, thinks of the consequences of war. The difference in their position comes down to the problem of means and ends. The clash between Krishna's and Arjuna's positions is no longer a question about which outcome would be worse, nor is it about choosing between two different outcomes. It is about choices between alternate paths. One of those paths entails inflicting terrible suffering in a war. End of quote. Das then goes on to say that not having succeeded in persuading Arjuna through argument, Krishna finally wins the debate by revealing his awe-inspiring form as God. Having done so, adds Das, Krishna essentially says that Arjuna should be aware that the fate of Bhishma and Drona had already been sealed. The Gita's words regarding this are as follows, and I now quote from the Gita, not Das. I am time, inflamed now and engaged in destroying the worlds. Even without thy slaying them, not one of the warriors arranged in battle against thee would survive. Therefore, do thou rise, fight, and earn glory. Defeat thy foes, conquer, and win an unrivaled kingdom. By me, these warriors have already been slain. Be thou therefore an instrument of mine, O Savyasachin. End of quote. Amazingly, at the end of it all, Krishna lets Arjuna decide whether he will fight or not. And Arjuna replies that he would do as God bid him to. That, says Das, is how Krishna wins the debate. I am sure you are feeling a bit dizzy after all that I have just rushed you through. I won't blame you if you did feel that way, for I have compressed a lot into a few pages. By the time Das comes to the point where Arjuna agrees to fight, he is on page 99. But you know what? The book goes on for another 205 pages. Since Das not only discussed the 18-day war, but also a bit of what happens after the war is over. I would, however, like to presently confine myself to issues related to the war as discussed in the chapter under consideration. And later I shall fast forward to where Das winds up his book to draw his conclusions about Dharma. This would enable us to see why Das draws a different picture of Dharma as compared to what we would be doing. With that in mind, let me go straight to the issue of war, particularly as war has presently become messy, fearsome, and absolutely deadly these days. Let us start with Arjuna's quandary about duty and his fear that war is bound to produce a sharp growth in vice and a corresponding decline in the observance of dharma. To put it simply, Arjuna refuses to fight in the belief that avoiding war would save dharma. Krishna, on the other hand, wants Arjuna to fight in order to prevent dharma from going into decline. Does that mean that war is always necessary in order to preserve dharma? Obviously not, but this is an issue that needs to be discussed carefully. And indeed, we shall do so later. Looks like I've added one more item to my to-do list. Many believe that the essence of the Gita is that Krishna advised Arjuna to fight. In other words, Gita is all about war. Actually, what Krishna did was to advise Arjuna to do his duty and not run away from it. Arjuna was a Kshatriya and it was his duty to uphold Dharma by protecting the good and containing the evil. If that required fighting and war, so be it. That is how Arjuna ended up fighting, by way of discharging his duty as a Kshatriya. The Gita is really a manual about the divine origin of duty. What exactly is one's duty in the particular situation one is placed in life, and how exactly one should discharge one's duty? To my knowledge, all these nuances have been clearly explained only by Swami. Later I would say more about all this, but for the present, let me just say that duty stroke action invariably pertains to circumstances related to the phenomenal world we live in. Of that, there can be no question. However, the basis for the action, or the motivation for the action, as Das often refers to it, must be rooted in a higher plane, that is to say, a plane above that of the mind. And that higher plane is nothing but the plane of the heart, the Atman, the Brahman, God, call it whatever you will. When duty is discussed in this fashion, from the perspective of a higher plane, automatically it brings in a whole gamut of issues ranging from dharma, moral dilemmas, the relationship between the individual, society, and so on, all the way to war and its consequences. It's a pity that Das chooses to bypass the Gita, describing it as just 700 fratricidal verses. Now, Arjuna raised a question about the havoc that war would cause. This is an important issue, and with respect to it, I would like to bring in President Obama. While delivering a speech on the occasion of the award of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, Obama said the following, and I quote, "The issue of the cost of armed conflict is filled with questions about the relationship between war and peace and our effort to replace one with the other." End of quote. War, Obama then reminded us, the quote again, appeared with the very first man. At the dawn of history, its morality was not questioned. It was simply a fact, like drought or disease. The man and his tribe, and then civilization sought power and settled their differences, was usually through war. End of quote. When the United Nations came into existence in 1946, the UN proclaimed in its charter that the peoples of the world were determined to, quote again, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors. End of quote. The Korean War, where one army faced another, started shortly after the UN declaration, and after that, now a decade and a half into the 21st century, we continue to see conflicts and war raging in many parts of the world, apart from organized terrorism. So war has not been put an end to. It continues more vigorously, in fact. What it shows is that notwithstanding their ability to excel in science and technology, when it comes to war and conflict, humans simply do not seem to be able to get rid of them. Everyone knows very well, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problems. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. Presently, there is really no true peace in many parts of the world. What we have is merely the suspension or the temporary absence of visible conflict. True peace, on the other hand, must spring from the hearts of people and, spreading as the fragrance of prashanti, peace or shanti must eclipse the foul odor of meanness, greed, jealousy and hatred. Then alone can peace prevail. Now going back to Krishna and Arjuna, I must mention that when I first read the Gita, Arjuna's arguments appealed to me quite a lot, especially because I was an ardent admirer of Mahatma Gandhi. At the same time, I was also aware that Gandhi himself set much store by the Gita. In fact, in my view, he was the one man I know of who tried to scrupulously follow the teachings of the Gita in the world of politics. So this clearly meant that the teachings of the Gita are subtle and cannot be dismissed lightly and superficially, as many intellectuals, including Gurchan Das, tend to. That being said, I could not really figure out why Krishna was giving the advice that he did. Arjuna says, I won't fight, and it seemed to be based on non-violence. And Krishna appeared to be denying non-violence. I couldn't understand it. It was only after carefully listening to Swami's discourses and going over them again and again and again, I was able to understand the flow of ideas in the Gita and how Krishna was giving a comprehensive message, the like of which had never been given before. Perhaps I could mention that my scientific training helped me, since in science we often encounter many facts which superficially seem discordant, but have a deep connection nevertheless when one looks closely. In my view, moral values and dharma cannot be discussed by keeping the Gita out and dismissing it. This I have stated several times in the current talk series, and I reiterate it one more. Having said that, my view of what Krishna told Arjuna would have to wait till the next talk, for the reason there is so much to say today, I do not have enough time left for doing anything else. Instead, I would like to return to the theme of 4, concerning which Das makes a number of pertinent and valuable comments. I begin with the following remark that Das makes on page 92 of his book. He says, quote, Karl von Clausewitz, the German strategist, set out to explain the inner meaning of war. He wrote, war has no limits to violence. The reason is that each of the adversaries forces the hand of the other, and this results in continuous escalation in which neither side is guilty, even if it acts first, since the very first act can be called preemptive. Once war begins, it invariably escalates without limit. Great tragedy is inescapable in war. End of quote. And thus adds, very pertinently, quote, when Winston Churchill made the decision to fight Adolf Hitler, he did not know that the war would escalate into the firebombing of German cities in which thousands of civilians would die. End of quote. The question of war has been extensively discussed by both scholars and politicians. An important contribution to this debate was made a long time ago by the Catholic scholar and philosopher St. Thomas Aquinas, to whom I made a reference in my last talk, I believe. In his dissertation, Summa Theologica, Aquinas added the concept of justum bellum, or just war, as it is better known. In the speech by Obama that I referred to earlier, Obama says, and I quote, over time, as codes of law sought to control violence within groups, so did philosophers, clerics, and statesmen seek to regulate the destructive power of war. The concept of a just war emerged, suggesting that war is justified only when it meets certain preconditions. End of quote. According to Das, those preconditions are the following. 1. When war is a defense against aggression or an attempt to stop atrocities. 2. The values at stake override the arguments against killing. That is to say, the expected good must outweigh the cost of killing and destruction. 3. War must be a last resort when all other alternatives have been exhausted. As far as I know, there have been very few just wars. Instead, the argument that might is right and the strong must rule the weak has been advanced right from the time of Duryodhana to the present day. Where diplomacy is concerned, some sophistication has been added by introducing the strategy of real politics. As Das says, This doctrine of real politics, made famous by Prince Metternich, the Austrian statesman at the Congress of Vienna in the 19th century, set the tone for the 20th century's balance of power diplomacy. Henry Kissinger, the American Secretary of State, has been the principal and most articulate proponent of real politics in recent times. Simultaneously, the view has grown that war is beyond law, and in times of war, the law is actually silent. Although some feel that morality does not apply to war, there are others like Kissinger who believe there is in fact a deeper morality to the ruthless implementation of real politics. Just to give an example, after World War II, the US and the USSR were allies during the war, very quickly fell apart, and a chill, intense Cold War that lasted till 1990 started in the 40s. And that was when the doctrine of balance of power had its highest moment. It was repeatedly argued that an intense eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation without either side actually starting a war. This situation, though tense, had at least the merit of avoiding a nuclear war. As a result, all the smaller countries were forced by the giants to join one camp or the other. It was always a case of you are either with us or you are against us. The idea of neutrality was anathema, especially to America, which always felt that the Cold War is the best thing amongst the bad option. And since it kept a nuclear war at bay, it was actually a good moral proposition for America to be in. To me, what stands out is the painful fact that wars continue to be fought, even as they get more and more deadly. Those in the world of politics would say that there are perfectly valid reasons why wars have not vanished, despite their growing horror. Here, let me quote Obama again, who says, and I quote, "We must acknowledge the hard truth that we will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. There will be occasions when nations, acting individually or in concert, will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified." I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King said in his address in this same ceremony years ago. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones." As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life's work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there is nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King. But as a head of a state sworn to protect and defend my country, I cannot be guided by their examples alone. I face the world as it is and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in this world. A non-violent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. To say that force is sometimes necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason. End of quote. After pointing out that peace is not merely the absence of visible conflict, but must be based on the dignity of humans, Obama goes on to say that even if lasting peace might seem elusive, we must not lose hope or faith. As he puts it, and I quote again, "For if we lose that faith, if we dismiss it as silly or naive, if we divorce it from the decisions that we make on issues of war and peace, then we lose what is best about humanity. We lose our sense of possibility. We lose our moral compass. So, let us reach out for the world that ought to be, that spark of the divine that still stirs within each of our souls." End of quote. You know what? I find Obama's appeal to reach out to the spark of the divine particularly striking, because it comes so close to what Swami told us so often, namely, that the starting point for global peace is for individuals to be at complete peace with themselves. This, added Swami, is what Shanti is all about. And that state
of equanimity and calmness descends on us when we identify ourselves with the spark of the divine within us. The more we make this identification, the more also would be the shanti we would experience. Swami goes on to say that like a rose that is not only beautiful, but also gives off a wonderful fragrance to make people who come near it happy, a person in a state of shanti would automatically be a calming influence on those in his presence. That is why many sought Ramana Maharishi's darshan, although Ramana was most silent most of the time. Furthermore, Swami has pointed out that wild animals, snakes and scorpions in forests never attack rishis meditating peacefully there. Swami says that if shanti is inner peace, then its calming external influence on others is prashanti. In other words, what it all adds up to is that peace is neither going to descend on earth like manna from heaven or can be found for us by politicians and diplomats. Rather, just as there cannot be national character without individual character, there cannot be global peace as long as we as individuals indulge in jingoism and constant saber-rattling. Hard as it might be, we must, all of us, and with unflinching faith, cling to the spark of the divine within us, rather than to fear, which is born out of all types of threat perception. Here it is pertinent to remind ourselves about what Swami has told about fear. He said, "Why fear when I am here?" I started off with Arjuna's question and Krishna's answer. In the process, I turned to the subject of war, especially since humankind seems stuck on waging war, despite it becoming increasingly efficient in causing death and destruction. In the Gita, Krishna traces this tendency to wage war to the mind, which cuts loose from the Atma to gain ascendancy, and thereafter starts dominating our actions and behavior. If instead we align our thoughts and actions to the Atma, then not only would we be vastly different as individuals, but by coming together as humanity as strongly as possible, we can also drive out fear, anger, hatred and war, replacing them with the atmosphere of shanti and the fragrance of prashanti. What Krishna told Arjuna was that at times a large-scale cleaning operation of a cathartic nature becomes necessary to regenerate the moral tenor of society. That was true of the situation that existed at the time of the Mahabharata war. That was why Krishna told Arjuna that war was necessary. As Swami once said, the knife must never be used to hurt another person. That being said, a surgeon uses a knife to cut out cancerous regions in the body. No one accuses the surgeon of being an evil man. Why? Because he is actually using the knife to remove something dangerous and save the patient. In the same way, said Swami, Arjuna was told to fight the Kauravas, since Krishna the Lord had already willed that the evil ones must die, so that Dharma may be protected. By fighting as ordered by Krishna, Arjuna would merely be acting as an instrument of the Lord. As such, no sin would come to him by virtue of obeying God's command. Now many are bound to ask the question, look, the world today is in a huge mess, horrendous mess. In fact, it would be no exaggeration to say that today's situation is far, far worse than it was at the time of the Mahabharata. In the Gita, Lord makes a categorical statement that whenever the observance of Dharma declines, he would incarnate, etc. The Lord came as Swami, and Swami has now withdrawn. What happens now to humanity and to the world at large? Who is going to fix all these problems? You may not believe it, but Swami has actually answered that question. To know what he said, you have to tune in to my next talk, since time is up for today. Meanwhile, I hope that what I have said so far is reasonably clear. Thank you very much for tuning in and hope you would not only continue to do so, but also pitch in with your questions. Offering this talk at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami, I now bring it to a close. God bless you and Jai Sai Ram.
Sairam, that brings to an end the 10th talk in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor Jivankatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service Love in Action with Raghu. Please stay tuned. Thank you and Sai Ram.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
बड़ा चित चोरा वृंदावन संचारा बड़ा चित बड़ा चित चोरा वृंदावन संचारा बड़ा चित गोपाल गोपाल के मुरली गोपाल 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 के मुरली गोपाल गोपाल गोवर्धनो धार गोपाल बाला गोपी मनोहर राधे गोपाल गोपी मनोहर राधे गोपाला बड़ा चित चोरा वृंदावन संचारा बड़ा चित चोरा वृंदावन संचारा गोपाला गोपाला के मुरली गोपाला 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 के मुरली गोपाला गोवर्धनोद्धार गोपाल बाला गोपी मनोहर राधे गोपाला बड़ा चित चोरा वृंदावन संचार गोपाला गोपाला हे मुरली
भज गोविंदम भज गोविंदम भज गोविंदम
भज गोविंदम भज गोविंदम
गोविंदम भज मूढ़मते गोविंदम भज मूढ़मते भज गोविंदम भज गोविंदम
भज गोविंदम
गोविंदम भज मूढ़मते संप्राप्ते सन्निहिते काले सन्निहिते काले नहि नहि रक्षति दुःखकरणे नहि नहि रक्षति दुःखकरणे पुनरपि जननम् पुनरपि मरणम्
పునరపి జననం పునరపి మరణం పునరపి జనని జఠరే శయనం ఇక సంసారే బహు దుస్తారే ఇక సంసారే బహు దుస్తారే సంసారే బహు దుస్తారే కృపయా పారే పాహి మురారే భజ గోవింద గోపాల ప్రభు గిరిధారి గోవింద గోపాల ప్రభు గిరిధారి
గోవింద గోపాల ప్రభు గిరిధారి
గోవింద గోపాల హృదయ విధారి
గోవింద
హృదయ విగారా బడా చిత్త చోరా
భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం మూఢమతే భజ భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం భజ మూఢమతే సంప్రాప్తే సన్నిహితే కాలే నహి నహి రక్షతి దుఃఖం కరణే నహి నహి రక్షతి దుఃఖం కరణే భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం గోవిందం భజ మూఢమతే గోవిందం భజ మూఢమతే సంప్రాప్తే సన్నిహితే కాలే నకి నకి రక్షతి దుఃఖం కరణే నహి నహి రక్షతి దుఃఖం కరణే భజ గోవిందం భజ గోవిందం గోవిందం భజ మూఢమతే
భవ భయ హరణ వందిత చరణ భవ భయ హరణ వందిత చరణ జయ రాఘ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ రాఘ జయ రాఘ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ మంగళ చరణ కలిమల దహన మంగళ చరణ కలిమల దహన నారాయణ కేశవ నారాయణ కేశవ జయ రాఘ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ రాఘ జయ రాఘ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ భవ భయ హరణ పండిత చరణ జయ రాధ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ రాధ జయ మాధవ చౌరీ జయ రాధ మంగళ చరణ కలిమల దహన మంగళ చరణ కలిమల దహన నారాయణ కేశవ శ్రీమన్నారాయణ కేశవా